Merciful heavens, eh? What a week it's been. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Now, originally, best laid plans and all that, I had anticipated that I'd be using this particular podcast to mop up some more issues relating to the elections, remember them? And then also perhaps, you know, maybe even throw in some book reviews or something else that was not quite so time sensitive. And then, of course, we had this awful terrorist attack on the Crocus music venue. So really, what else can I be talking about? So I will talk at first about the terrorist attack and then after the break about the elections. It will probably be a little bit rambling because in some ways it is more about a grab bag of issues that I think are worth discussing rather than some sort of carefully structured, formulated argument. But here we go anyway. As I said, sometimes we just have to follow the news where it takes us, and obviously where it's taken us at the moment has been to a very dark place with this terrorist attack. More than 130 dead, quite possibly more still to come from the people who are wounded. And, of course, Putin trying to suggest that there is this sort of Kyiv connection, that somehow these Tajik terrorists were, of course, heading for the Ukrainian border where a window was going to be opened across to them. I'm not quite sure quite what that window would be, given the degree to which it is a highly militarized but also fortified border. And also that a window is no use if it's only on one side. The implication is, therefore, how are they going to get across the Russian lines? But anyway, so let me start by talking about the actual real, or much more likely to be real, perpetrators of this awful attack, which is, of course, ISIS-K, or Islamic State Khorasan, which is one of the particular affiliates. Remember, Islamic State has, as much as anything else, become a brand as an organisation. And it's the element of Islamic State that is particularly present in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and in Central Asia. And for the Russians, this has actually been a long-term threat. It's worth noting, after all, that since 2016, there have been about half a dozen successful attacks, including the St. Petersburg metro bombing in, oh heavens, I think it was 2017. But anyway, some severe attacks carried out by Islamic State Khorasan, ISK, but also a lot of attacks that actually never come to fruition. And this is one of the problems, particularly for those of us who are not necessarily watching terrorist incidents in Russia all the time, is that you only hear not even just simply about the successful attacks, but usually the substantial successful attacks, or the ones that take place in or around Moscow and St. Petersburg. In fact, there is a regular tally of incidents where attacks seem to be foiled. Most recently, and I'll talk more about that, on the 7th of this month, there was an alleged armed attack planned on a synagogue in Kaluga region, which was actually foiled. But again, you know, at the time, it didn't really make the news, though it will turn out in some ways to be rather more significant. ISIS-K has long actually regarded Russia as being one of its main enemies. You know, way back at its formation, there was the warning, let Crusader Russia and its allies know that the Mujahideen, in other words, the sort of holy warriors, do not forget to take revenge. So, in this sense, why? Well, from their point of view, Russia is at least a lesser Satan, if America is the great Satan, but probably from their point of view, actually quite analogous. They point to, for example, the brutal wars against Chechnya, which you might say the first Chechen War was essentially a war against Chechen nationalism and secessionism. The second Chechen War did have a very, very heavy religious dimension because jihadist movements, particularly Al-Qaeda, had by that point, you know, heavily penetrated the rebel movement and indeed arguably sort of taken it over. So as far as they're concerned, the Chechen War. Then they also look at what happened in Syria from 2015 onwards, when the Russians went in to support Bashar al-Assad's government, fighting a collection of rebels, including Islamic State there. And generally, they regard Moscow as being, you know, in hand, working hand in hand with, for example, governments in Central Asia, which are also trying to suppress Islamic State K there. So as far as they're concerned, the friend of my enemy is my enemy, and that all gives enough reason to be attacking Russia. And they use a whole variety of tactics. I mean, on the one hand, they are quite strongly represented, it's still small numbers, of course, amongst radicalized figures within the huge millions and millions strong Central Asian, both resident but also temporary guest worker contingent within Russia. But they also, as seems to be the case, certainly based on the kind of initial information we're getting, are willing to basically outsource and essentially hire people for as mercenaries, let's call it that way, who are not necessarily radicalized. So in terms of not just their own multiple claims of responsibility, even to the point of actually providing video footage and pictures of the terrorist attackers. But nonetheless, also just in terms of the MO, this really does look perfectly like an Islamic State Khorasan attack. And the interesting thing is that, quite frankly, even I think the professional Russian audience appreciates that too. So although if you look at today's press, and I'm recording this on Sunday the 24th of March, in the more tabloid-type end, the sort of things like Komsomolskaya and Pravda, they very much hype the Ukraine dimension. If one looks at Rossiyskaya Gazeta, the rather sort of stodgy heavyweight paper of record, actually there's almost nothing about Ukraine there. Whereas also if one looks at the slightly more sort of, shall I say, elevated discussions, which we'll find sort of amongst people with professional connections on social media, they're very much talking much more Islamic State. And that's why there's an interesting distinction between what, shall we say, the professional Russians seem to be accepting and Putin's own narrative. So let me turn to that. Apparently, three times Russian TV news channels or TV channels were told to expect a presidential address to the nation as this terrible incident was playing out. But eventually, after almost 20 hours, he did finally come out. And again, this is classic Putin. If he doesn't really know what to say, if he's faced with tough issues, and usually in the immediate context of something going disastrously wrong, think, for example, back to the Prigozhin mutiny, he tends to basically hide behind the sofa. So that's not unusual. But anyway, when he did come out and make his relatively brief 5 or so minutes address, I must admit, I thought it was a pretty lackluster performance. I mean, in some ways, he was in a tough position anyway. He did have to double down on his threats about, you know, whoever was behind this would end up paying. There were the implications of a Ukraine connection. No mention of Islamic State, even though by this point Islamic State had already declared its responsibility. I'm beginning to wonder if actually Islamic State is going to become the new Navalny, the threat that Putin dares not name. And I also wonder if there was a degree, quite frankly, of embarrassment, not just simply that the attack could take place, but also in the context of the American warnings, which I'll talk about in a moment. And look, this idea that there was this Ukrainian connection is looking pretty iffy. Now, apparently, the terrorists who were apprehended, they were actually apprehended in Bryansk region, which is towards the Ukrainian border. But actually, it's also pretty close to Belarus. And quite frankly, if one was thinking of a potential escape route, I would have thought that via Belarus, given that the Russian-Belarusian border is essentially an open border, sounds a lot more sensible. Although I will note that Medusa have geolocated the arrest of one of the various militants to a place called Khartoum, 140 kilometres from the Ukrainian border and sort of rather further from Belarus. So maybe that's uncertain, but as I say, I still think that the idea that they were heading for a heavily militarised border, one that actually is a sort of sporadic war zone, quite frankly, especially given to the incursions from various pro-Ukrainian Russian groups, that still doesn't sound incredibly plausible to me at this stage. So why is Putin doubling down on this notion that somehow the Ukrainians were involved? Well, look, on one level, in the most general terms, of course, it's always useful to demonise the Ukrainians. The vilification of the Ukrainians has become part of the way of justifying the war as a whole. I'm not so convinced, though, that it has such a value to him as instrumentalised as a way of justifying some kind of action. I mean, some people are saying, oh, well, this will be the basis for the alleged mobilisation. We had the media outlet Vyorstka claiming that, in fact, Putin planned to mobilise an extra 300,000 men, but to do so without an open mobilisation. Well, good luck to him with that one. But nonetheless, that's one of the claims, or that it justifies some kind of escalation in Ukraine. Look, I think that the Russians are mobilising as quickly as they can, short of a full-on mobilisation wave. And as regards attacking Ukraine, well, to be perfectly honest, the Russians are perfectly capable of fabricating reasons or just doing it without reasons. I mean, the current sort of wave of air attacks, frankly, would have been planned well in advance of the terrorist act, and there's no real suggestions that it's actually directly connected. So, yes, there is a general value in using the Ukraine dimension as a way of trying to distract attention from the real threat, and also just simply as a way of supporting his narrative that Ukraine is a sort of naturally terroristic state, and thus what else can the Russians do but deal with it and denazify it and so forth. But I wouldn't necessarily push it any further. But of course, this is also play to the narrative, or frankly the conspiracy theory, that the whole thing is a false flag operation, that it was actually carried out or permitted by the Russian security forces as a way of providing that kind of justification. Now, we seem to get this claim of false flag almost every time something like this happens. And really, the only basis for this is in the 1999 apartment bombings, which absolutely do look very, very questionable, and certainly paved the way for the rise of a hard man like Putin to the presidency. And whether Putin himself was behind it, or whether it was more the sort of shadowy cabal of forces who had decided that Putin was their choice to succeed Yeltsin who were responsible, I think that's entirely plausible. You know, but one way or the other, I'm perfectly willing to believe that those were indeed arranged for political value. But beyond that, this is not some kind of classic Kremlin tactic, no matter what people will claim. And it certainly didn't help that Khur, Ukrainian military intelligence, immediately came out and again claimed that, in fact, it was all a Kremlin plot. But let's unpack some of the bases that people use to claim that this was clearly a conspiracy. First of all, there is the sort of generic one. Oh, well, Russia's a security state. You can't go and protest without police arresting you within 5 minutes. There's cameras everywhere, etc. How on earth could terrorists have been able to launch this kind of an attack? Well, look, first of all, let's acknowledge the essential, I wouldn't say incompetence, but shall we say partial competence, demi-competence of the Russian security apparatus. Arresting peaceful protesters in the middle of Moscow is easy. This is not quite the same. This actually is an admission of the fact that, you know, unless you have particular good intelligence connections, and I'll come on to that later, it's often quite difficult to identify terrorist plots, especially relatively small-scale ones, before they happen. Sometimes terrorists will always get through, regardless of how able your counterintelligence officers, how many police you've got, how many cameras you have, and the like. So, you know, it's a general thing of saying, oh, well, this kind of thing could not happen without the connivance of the Russian state. I mean, that's just a very weak argument. The second notion is some people are saying there was no security, there was no private security at the Crocus venue. Well, that's just palpably not true. I mean, the Agalarovs, the owners of the venue, they've said it themselves. I mean, yes, these were unarmed security officers. You know, these are just ordinary the sort of people who are there just to wave you through, make sure you've got your ticket and such like. No wonder that, frankly, most of them disappeared as soon as the shooting started, quite rightly. Though there were cases, there's at least one security guard who seems to have died and other accounts of security guards helping people get out. So, you know, this is just simply not true. And I think this is one of the key problems we find in today's social media age, is that someone just kind of throws out some kind of allegation, maybe based on the fact that they looked at a couple of videos and didn't see anybody who looked obviously like a security guard, and they just simply claim
that, oh, well, there were no security guards, which is very unusual, therefore this was a put-up job. The third thing that I've seen is instance is the fact that these guys had guns. And again, this carries with the implication that somehow Russia is this, you know, ruthlessly efficient police state in which no one can get illegal guns. That is sadly absolutely not the case at any time, but particularly not since February 2022. As I've talked about in other cases and covered in my report for the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, there is now a proliferation of military-grade firearms currently on the black market, courtesy of the war. And the sort of backflow of stuff that just simply disappears, trophies picked up off the battlefield, weapons that veterans bring home. And in that context, it is depressingly easy for people who want to find guns to be able to get hold of them if they have the money and the connections. So, you know, that too doesn't really hold water. And finally, this notion that it took an hour before the authorities actually got to the place. Well, firstly, again, I think that statement of it took an hour is, again, one of these things that someone alleges and then just simply becomes kind of read into the record because no one bothers digging into it. Looking at the video, it looks as if within about, I don't know, 30, 35 minutes of the start of the incident, there were law enforcement and some emergency services on the scene. Now, given that actually the terrorists themselves seem to have got out after about 20 minutes... 30 minutes isn't really that far off. I mean, some people have pointed to the fact that about a 10-minute drive away from the venue, there is a sort of base of the AMON. That's the National Guard Riot Police, who also provide sort of armed response in this and similar situations. Sure, just a 10-minute drive away, no question. However, people who seem to think that, you know, riot police spend their shift sitting in their vans fully tooled up don't really get the situation. First of all, you know, imagine the chaos. How long would it have been after the incident starts before someone actually calls 112 to alert the emergency services? Then someone has to decide what's going on and what's the best response. One of the issues created by forming the National Guard in the first place is it took the AMON and other sort of specialist armed response units out of the direct control of the police. So the police would have been the first people who get the call. Once they realised what they were talking about, they would have had to basically go and contact the National Guard. Now, again, I'm sure this only takes a couple of minutes, but still, every minute counts in this context. Then the National Guard decide, okay, we need to send some AMON. Let's say they send them here. We'll assume that the AMON at that base were not already deployed somewhere else. But then they have to be issued with their guns and ammunition. They do not just simply sort of sit around, loaded assault rifles on their knee, loaded up into their vehicles, and then driven to the venue. Now, again, each of these steps only takes a little bit of time, probably, but put it all together, it helps explain why, just as in other mass killing incidents that we've seen, whether it's in terms of Prague or Paris or wherever, it does take time for that first response, particularly when the first response has to be tooled up to deal with it. So put it all together, you know, it's always very difficult to actually prove a negative, but certainly I have not seen any signs that this necessarily needs to be a false flag operation, or indeed that it's actually particularly useful for Putin to have had it as a false flag operation. The 1991 apartment bombings were perfectly pitched from that point of view. They were absolutely shocking, and they made this case both why Chechnya need to be subdued, because it was obviously the terrorism was blamed on the Chechens, but also why Russia needed a tough, security-aware president. And lo and behold, Putin was just such a figure. This time, as I say, this is, and I'll come to this more in a moment, this is not looking that useful for Putin. And one of the issues is, of course, this question of the United States intelligence. How far were the Russians given a warning? And how far did Putin himself, therefore, decide to actually discount it and can therefore be considered sort of morally to blame? Well, look, it's really not very clear. And in part, the trouble is that we are dealing with, shall we say, dueling news outlets. American sources saying that specific and actionable intelligence was provided to the Russians, and the Russians saying, well, it was actually all quite general. we await some kind of proper information one way or the other. So far, at least, I have to say, I do lean slightly on the notion that it was probably more general. In other words, it was saying, look, and frankly, this has been apparently going back to November of last year, that we think that ISK wants to launch a terrorist attack in Russia, maybe even in Moscow, and that it's likely to be at some major public event. But that in itself is not really enough necessarily to go on. So we don't know just how far it went beyond that. What we do know is that on the 7th of March, when there was this abortive attack on a synagogue in Kaluga, that's when the United States Embassy in Moscow did put out a warning to US citizens in Russia, saying them that there was a risk of terrorist attacks in public places and gatherings, such as concerts. It did mention them. But it also said over the next 48 hours. So that was on the 7th of March, so way earlier. One would presume, surely, that if the Americans had more specific information, such as that, you know, maybe that the threat would also be later in March, or that definitely at a concert, then they would have notified their own citizens. Now, that said, they also passed on this warning to the Russians. They have this sort of duty to report, but also it has to be noted that at this current time, when so much law enforcement and security cooperation has been suspended, good for the Americans for actually going ahead and telling the Russians what was happening. And in that context, it was churlish as well as stupid for Putin to, Putin poo-pooed it. He called it a sort of a provocation. He said it was an attempt just simply to try and sort of stir up disruption within Russia. He may well have been genuinely of the view that it was a mischievous plot. Remember, Putin has a tendency to mirror image. And therefore, you know, because he's the kind of malicious little sod who would actually perhaps use fake intelligence warnings as a way of trying to undermine someone else's elections, he may well have assumed that, in fact, this is what the Americans were doing to him. One way or the other, though, he not only, as a result, undermined any particular value from this intelligence, but also threw away a very, very small opportunity, possibly to rebuild the most microscopic of bridges with the West in terms of sort of Islamic State as our common foe. I mean, okay, not even a bridge, maybe at most a rope thrown across the river, the raging torrent of animosity these days. But nonetheless, you know, one way or the other, clearly this did not have a dramatic impact. Whether it was actionable, you know, and specific, who knows. But it is worth noting one thing, is that there have been some signs of increased police action in recent days. And according to one Muscovite who lives close to the Crocus venue, apparently the night before there had been quite a major National Guard operation in the area, sort of searches and such like. So, you know, the implication is the Russian security apparatus, at least, whatever Putin may have said, did not completely discount it. But think about it, what was their real alternative? If what they have is just something very general saying that Islamic State may well launch an attack, are they going to cancel all events in Moscow in the month of the presidential elections? And at the very time when Putin is trying to project a business as usual kind of mantra, even during the time of war. It isn't exactly sort of this kind of thorny dilemma that people involved in counterterrorism have to deal with all the time. And although, obviously, the outcome is tragic, one can't truly say that it was somehow monstrously irresponsible and out of the usual kind of practice that, unless there was something rather more precise, the Russians didn't, for example, you know, close down all public events. So, again, as ever, the truth is just so often much more boring, much more banal than the sort of exciting news that one would get on, say, Twitter. Okay, can we expect more of these kind of attacks? Well, I mean, the honest answer is, of course, who knows? Yeah, I would say that if we look at past incidents where Islamic State Khorasan has launched successful terrorist attacks, they don't tend to have a whole sequence of them, whether it's just simply because they don't have the resources or whatever else. So, you know, insofar as past activity is any predictor of future activity, all one can really say is not necessarily. But on the other hand, although one can imagine stepped up security operations yet again, it's actually really quite hard for the Russians. This is the irony. For so long, they've been fighting terrorist movements from the North Caucasus, Chechnya, etc. And to be blunt, they got, in their own characteristically thuggish way, quite good at it. They have a lot of sort of seasoned analysts who really understand the people and the movements in question. They have whole networks of informants. They know the drill. And it's one of the reasons why, frankly, the Islamic State affiliate in the North Caucasus actually is pretty minimalist and keeps suffering from all kinds of reversals. The real problem, though, has been, as I mentioned, dealing with actually radicals coming from Central Asia and the radicalization of some of the Central Asians in Russia. These are people who, in many cases, do the kind of miserable hard labor that Russians really don't want to, being paid the kind of salaries that Russians wouldn't want to accept. And in those circumstances, they often live in very, very cheap communal accommodation, sometimes in sort of virtual kind of work camps. But also within their communities, they're often drawn from the same neighborhood, the same village. They know each other one way or the other. In those circumstances, it's actually very hard to recruit or to place agents within these communities. You can't have someone come turning up and saying, "Hello, I'm your cousin whom you've never heard of before." In addition, I mean, the Russians make a lot of use, like so many internal security services these days, of monitoring smartphones, the communications, and simply their locations. With the Central Asians, we have a situation where often actually there will be effectively communal smartphones that different, you know, multiple people use. And in that context, again, it's very, very hard to therefore link a smartphone to a person. As a result, the Russians often have to rely on intelligence that they get from their Central Asian counterparts. And this is often a serious problem. Central Asian intelligence services or internal security services are often, I would say, deeply questionable. I mean, they make, quite frankly, the Russian intelligence community look pretty upstanding and moral, and also they make them look pretty professional. There's all sorts of cases of either highly politicized information being passed on, so, you know, because someone just simply is a critic of the regime, they're being labeled a supporter of Islamic State or whatever, or just simply, you know, muddled. I remember, and I mentioned this in a piece that I wrote for the Sunday Times today, a particular case I was heard about from a former FSB officer who said that at one point they had received a sort of bunch of dossiers from the DXX, which is the very, very notorious Uzbek security service, and which ended up muddling names and also muddling dates of birth, that are often one of the kind of key ways in which you identify people. And as a result, they had this operation all ready to roll, about to arrest what they thought was a 20-year-old who had been fighting for Islamic State in Afghanistan and had just returned to Russia. In fact, though, if they had actually launched that operation, they would have found themselves arresting a 50-something-year-old visiting university professor because names and dates of birth had got muddled up. So, you know, a lot of the information that they're having to try and work from is actually of questionable quality. So, you know, for all of these reasons, this really is the FSB and the rest of the security apparatus's nightmare. Central Asian radicalism from a huge community that is, you know, although you particularly see it around major cities like Moscow, but frankly scattered all across the country, relatively enclosed and encapsulated, often quite highly mobile, as, you know, people come in, you know, obviously a lot of these are temporary workers. So they come to Russia to send remittances back home. They may well work for a year or a season before going back home because they've made enough money to build a house or whatever it is. But then they may well come out again. So, you know, again, it's a very fluid population, quite hard to keep tracks. And although obviously the overwhelming majority of these are not in any way radicals, but there are radicals amongst them. And so it is going to be hard to actually kind of close off that particular route. And that brings me then to the final point I want to talk about, which is, well, what on earth can be done? Well, we can expect, as is always the case in all countries, quite frankly, a sudden upsurge in security theatre. The kind of actions which are there precisely to make the population feel comfortable, feel reassured, feel that the state is on top of the problem, even if in fact it does bugger all good. So this will be, you know, lots of armed security personnel on the streets and pat down searches and using the metal detector gates much more assiduously at metro stations and the like. Massive drain on resources, probably pretty minimal impact, but as I say, that's essentially it's a political act. What will be interesting to see, and in some ways I wonder if it's precisely because he doesn't want to do this that Putin is stressing the Ukraine dimension, but otherwise we could have expected a crackdown on Central Asians. But again, this is actually problematic. You know, Russia needs those Central Asian workers. Russia is currently in the midst of a labour crisis. Between the demands of the war and the demands of the defence industrial complex, actually there is real pressure for workers, and therefore it can't afford to alienate and drive out Central Asians by treating them too heavy-handedly. And also, interestingly, Central Asian governments are becoming increasingly independent, increasingly unwilling to basically let Russia do what it wants. We've already seen, you know, when there was the first identification of the alleged attackers as Tajiks, the Tajik government getting quite furious about this. Now, we'll have to see how that plays out. But so, you know, there are political risks to scapegoating the Central Asians. As regards the Ukrainians, well, again, it may be politically useful just in terms of generally demonising Kyiv, but there's no obvious and, shall we say, I hate to say this, satisfying kind of response that is available. I mean, frankly, when you have been spending over 2 years pounding every possible target you can get away with, what else is there that really can be done? And so as a result of all this, I do think it is bad news for Putin. You know, we go back to ultimately his legitimacy was based on the two faces of Vladimir Putin, appropriately enough. There is the smiling face of Putin, the great provider, the man who ensures that the quality of life for ordinary Russians will get appreciably better. And as a result, they can afford to surrender politics to him. And then there is the scowling face of Putin, the macho defender of the motherland. And the thing is that obviously these days, Putin the provider, well, that's no longer really available to him. For most Russians, life is not getting better, and most Russians do not necessarily feel the kind of optimism that in fact their kids are going to have a much better life than them, etc. That element of the social contract has been broken. So instead, Putin has to double down on his role as the tough defender of the motherland. And this has been so much an element of his rhetoric around the imperialist war in Ukraine. That is actually not an aggressive military adventure. Of course not. It's an attempt to defend Russia from the depredations of the Ukrainian neo-Nazis, who are in turn cat's paws of a hostile and conspiratorial West. As I've talked in the past, I'm not convinced that that has massive traction with the majority of Russians, at least. But the point is, that carries with it the idea that he can protect the Russian people. And what are we seeing? Well, they're now finding an increasing tempo of Ukrainian drone attacks hitting, well, particularly oil refineries at the moment, but essentially able to roam over much of the country. And now they've also had a catastrophic terrorist attack, the worst in 2 decades. In that context, look, I'm not expecting any kind of sudden sort of dramatic shift. But that slow eating away at Putin's legitimacy, that slow and accelerating sense that this is no longer the Putin that was, that he's no longer really fit for the times, that he's no longer able to deliver on his promises, I think that is going to become more and more of an issue. And as I say, at the moment, that doesn't necessarily mean very much. He's just awarded himself, after all, 80% of the vote. He considers himself to have a mandate. But it will in time. This slow eating away at the system increasingly leaves Putin in a position where all he is doing is sitting on a throne of bayonets. And we all know how uncomfortable that is. But speaking of his throne, let's take a break and then let me talk briefly about the elections.
Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode.
Now, before I start, just a quick note of a couple of forthcoming public appearances. On the 8th of April, I'll be in Vienna, speaking at the Kreisky Forum for International Dialogue. And then on the 16th of May, I'll be giving a public lecture at Newcastle University. I will leave links to both of those events in the programme notes. So, the elections. Wow, I mean, it seems so long ago now. But anyway, here we are. What last bits and pieces can one say now that we've actually got the results? First of all, let's talk about that overall figure, 87%. Now, I had mentioned in my previous podcast some degree of uncertainty as to how far Putin would necessarily decide to reach or overreach in terms of demanding that kind of crashing, overwhelming mandate at the time of war. 87% clearly represents a continued sort of extension. As has been noted, I mean, if, you know, it was actually 87 point something. So if we call it 88%, he's more or less moved from 77% to 88%, which of course means the natural logical progression would be 99% next time round. We shall see. Either way, though, this absolutely represents a flex, an attempt to basically assert power. I still do go back to this wonderful Russian word, vranyo, which is not just a lie, but the kind of lie that I say with a straight face, knowing that you're not going to believe me, but in effect making a challenge. So what are you going to do about it then? And forcing you to actually swallow this lie. And I think that's what, to a degree, this represents. This is an attempt to basically assert power and really mark the transition from a period in which at least there was the pretense that an election is the chance for the Russian people to choose who will lead them, and now turn this into a ritual in which the Russian people formally subordinate themselves to their master. So in this respect, I mean, I do think that it actually represents something of a potentially sort of risky strategy, but frankly, an inevitable strategy, as we see the increasing authoritarian of this regime. And look, this clearly represents the last stage of dramaturgia and any kind of sort of hybrid authoritarianism. So what was the real answer? Well, look, obviously, we don't really know. There's been some interesting statistical analysis that has suggested that it could even be that half of the votes were either fabricated or reallocated from the candidate they were genuinely given to. Now, okay, even if we take that half of the vote, this doesn't mean that in practice, actually, Putin only has 43.5% support. Because on the one hand, well, actually, polls before the vote were suggesting 60 to 65%, which, to be honest, for me, just on a purely impressionistic level, feels much more accurate and certainly is in line with at least one polling station at which independent observers were able to show their actual result. But on the other hand, we also have to recognise how far of this continuing sort of high vote for Putin, which we need to stress is sustained at a low level, way lower than the overall approval ratings. So, you know, I keep hammering away at this. Do not regard the approval ratings as genuine approval ratings. They are in many ways, shall we say, acceptance ratings. But anyway, as I said, the actual result is likely to be rather smaller even than the 60-odd percent that I mentioned. In part, that also represents a certain degree of kind of pressure on, yes, you know who you're meant to vote for. It also represents the absolute lack of any kind of real opposition. You know, if there were credible other candidates, whether on the ballot paper or actually in sort of general political currency, people might well be thinking very differently. I mean, at present, it is very hard to assess Putin, because where is the yardstick to use for that? And finally, more broadly, a lack of stake. What I mean by that is, when you know full well that you have no chance of affecting the issue of who gets to run your country, how far do you really care about it? Whether you're actually in a polling station, or whether you're being asked by a clipboarded pollster, you know, do you bother to even think about it, or do you just simply say Putin as the line of least resistance? So I think for all of these reasons, we should appreciate the fragility of Putin's support base. Now, of course, for that very reason, he is never going to allow there to be any kind of real competition. You know, not for him, the relative, I would say, self-confidence when Sobyanin actually pushed for Navalny to be allowed onto the ballot in the mayoral elections in Moscow. Now, obviously, it was a calculated decision by Sobyanin. He felt that thanks to his own stature and standing, but also his administrative resource, he could still win that election. And as a result, by standing against Navalny and winning, that would give him a much, much greater charge of legitimacy. And indeed it did. So, in practice, kudos to him. Putin is not going to take that risk. The stakes are too great. The risks are, frankly, too dangerous for him. But nonetheless, I do think that if there was any kind of real competition, we would see that Putin figure crumble really quite dramatically. I find myself wondering still, though, how far does Putin know all this? You know, we know in so many other ways, after all, that Putin is insulated from the bad news. Whether it's in terms of the fact that his assumptions about Ukrainians are completely off beam, and what he's envisaging as a successful two-week police action is going to turn into a God knows how many years viciously fought war, or in terms of so many other aspects of policy. You know, people tell Putin what they would like Putin to know, and frankly, Putin has created a system in which people do not tell him things he does not want to know. So, I do find myself wondering, does Putin genuinely believe he has an 87% mandate? Surely not. But does he appreciate just how potentially fragile his vote is? That may well not be the case. Look, I honestly don't know. But I just think it's something that we should bear in mind. In so many ways, we have a tendency often to assume, in the absence of clear evidence to the contrary, that Putin is a pretty clear-eyed and properly informed figure. And my view is that actually so much of what's happened can be explained by the fact that Putin is an essentially rational actor, but nonetheless who believes a lot of deeply irrational things, but more to the point is often, I think, fed inaccurate or more likely partial and slanted perspectives on what's happening in the country around him. You know, what are Putin's independent sources of information? The answer is, I don't think he has any. So in that context, I really would be so fascinated to know, how far is Putin aware of the electoral map? When we talk about that electoral map, I mean, clearly it was amongst other things, a test of the local power structures, with governors and mayors and the like being given quotas and expectations. So, for example, I think, clearly we see Moscow's result for Putin as being much closer to the overall result than in past elections. And I think, from a certain degree, that represents as a brownie point for Sobyanin. But more generally, one of the issues that has been raised, and it will be quite interesting, is in fact that maybe this vote was a little bit higher, frankly, even than the presidential administration's political technologists had planned. And this might have been a situation where, remember, obviously there's the electoral voting, there's the complexities created by the fact that the vote took place over 3 days. But broadly speaking, if you just think of the time zones, it means that, shall we say, the moment of truth rolls westwards from the Russian Far East. Polling stations close in the East earlier, the count comes in earlier in there. And there is that sense that maybe certain regions, actually the local governors had decided that they wanted to overfulfill the plan and actually go beyond what was expected of them. And whether it was because of a chronological factor or whether just simply this became known and others felt, well, I can't let myself be outflanked by my political rivals. And others jumped on board to also overplan and as a result perhaps produce a slightly higher result than the Kremlin itself had planned for. It's a little bit of a parallel with what happened, after all, in Stalin's collectivization and his purges. That, you know, people compete to demonstrate their loyalty and their efficiency to the point where, during the collectivization campaign, Stalin actually has to call a halt, temporary halt, I should stress, at one point with his so-called Dizzy with Success letter, in which he basically sort of says, calm it down, guys. Things are going too far. They're too disruptive. Now, obviously, that was a longer process. There's no scope for a Dizzy with Success moment in the context of the elections. But nonetheless, it speaks to the fact that we also need to look at the elections from the perspective of a self-interested political machine that often regards the best route to survival and success as being to please Putin by doing more than he would have expected or doing what he might have wanted before he even knew he wanted it. So, what can we now expect? Well, as I mentioned, there may well be some kind of a reshuffle. I do wonder if I can link the two issues together. If, in fact, this terrorist attack, which, let's be honest, has to be considered another blunder by the Federal Security Service, another failure to identify a serious threat, whether this means we will finally get Bortnikov, Alexander Bortnikov, head of the FSB, a man who's known to be ailing as well as aging. And, you know, and for so long there's been talk that any day now he's going to go, well, you know, any day now he may end up going. We still need to keep an eye on what happens to Kiryenko, the first deputy head of the presidential administration and the guy who basically orchestrated the elections. Is he going to move back into government structures, the first deputy prime minister or something else like that? But more generally, absolutely, let's just close the book on the whole panoply of managed democracy, dramaturgia, hybrid authoritarianism, and just recognise that this is a straightforward authoritarianism. Nothing particularly surprising about that, but depressing nonetheless. Okay, that's all I was going to talk about on those two issues. There is just one last issue, an entirely personal one that I wanted to raise, and that is of, for want of a better word, civility. I must admit that looking at how the terrorist attack has played out in terms of the commentary on social media, and particularly we're talking about, you know, what was once and frankly still is Twitter, the X, the degree to which there is an unholy, frankly on some parts, enthusiasm for what happened in Moscow. So much so that actually I felt at some point the need to actually write a tweet saying, look, one can both criticise this vicious war in Ukraine carried out by Russia and at the same time deplore and feel compassion for the victims of terrorism in Moscow. And I honestly was rather saddened that I felt the need to point that out anyway, because I think most people understand that. But what was also then striking was how much pushback I got. I mean, I did get a lot of support, and on the whole I got much more support than pushback, let me say that. But nonetheless, there was a striking amount of pushback from people saying, well, why should I feel compassion? Well, certainly, or why should the Ukrainians feel compassion? As if I'd actually been addressing specifically Ukrainians. But anyway, you know, about given what's happening to Ukrainians. And look, first of all, there is no competition here. There is not actually a finite amount of compassion. One can give it to both. Secondly, you can't really, on the one hand, talk about Russia as having had a sham election, and at the same time talking about how the majority of Russians support Putin and the war in Ukraine and the like. One or the other, but not both. Beyond that, even if you think that Russians are responsible for what's the awful, awful things that are happening in Ukraine, first of all, surely you don't think that also about the children who died at Crocus City. I mean, again, you know, one has to recognise that there are going to be degrees of involvement. But more broadly, it is also quite clear that actually, sure, there is a depressingly substantial component of Russians who broadly speaking support the war in one way or another. They may not support or even be aware of the terrible war crimes and atrocities that take place, but still, they are supportive of the war, fair enough. A large proportion, likely a majority, do not. The fact that they've not been able to prevent this war from happening does not necessarily make them delighted and willing accomplices. And here's the final backstop. Look, there's two issues. First of all, basic humanity. To say, I will not show compassion for Russians because Russians are not showing compassion for Ukrainians, seems to miss that fairly fundamental point that we, meaning in this case a sort of the Western community and whatever else, are meant to be better. It is not actually that you have to earn the right to be considered human. It is in fact that surely we should accept that human beings are human beings, and because the government of one country is doing horrible things does not necessarily mean that we should accept, or in some cases welcome. I mean, there have been posts I have seen where people have been saying, not enough Russians got killed there. So we should not be welcoming the deaths either. And even if you don't accept the moral argument, and I fully appreciate that this is just my own view, even if you don't accept that, how about a practical argument? How about thinking about the effects on Russia of a kind of widespread campaign of people basically saying Russia asked for it, Russians, ordinary Russians asked for it, and they deserve this. They do read, they are aware of what happens in this wider social media universe, not least because the Russian state will make fullest advantage of this and actually use it as part of its whole propaganda campaign. Do we really want to be helping Putin's propagandists? The answer is, I think not. On a purely Machiavellian level, we still need to be doing what we can to cultivate ordinary Russians, not least for whenever there is a post-Putin era. So my view is this, on a level of humanity as well as practicality, do think before you tweet. Anyway, I will now end. I promise not to get on my soapbox too often. Thank you very much for listening this far. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.